So welcome to our podcast, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which I'm doing in conjunction with a wonderful organisation called Online Events. And we're now on the second tranche of podcasts. We did the first 10. And we're calling it Slay Your Dragons with Compassion, which is the same title as my book. And it's basically about people's moments that have changed their lives and what they've taken on, and often what their suffering has brought them, what the difficulties have brought them, and where they've got to in their lives. And most of us, I think pretty much all of us, go through scenarios where our lives change because of random events that happen and where we get to. And I'm very grateful to our listeners for listening to this podcast. I just saw today we had over 1,000 downloads on the first tranche. And I'm really sort of like looking forward. We had Terence Stamp as the opening one for the second tranche. And I'm very, very honoured to have Colin Lester OBE. And that's pretty amazing that as Colin said when he told me, he's the son of immigrants who's actually sort of got himself an award that is really highly rated and doesn't come easily as well. So I think we'll start with your OBE, Colin, but then I would like to take a look at some of your journey, which has been pretty extraordinary, and what you do. So big welcome, and look forward to hearing and engaging with you and chatting on this.
Great. Malcolm, it's a pleasure to be on here. You are, without a shadow of a doubt, one of my inspirations. You know, you just keep on keeping on, you know, and I think just going back to talking about initially about Melissa and what the book is about, and how you got Slay Your Dragons into perspective for you and how it helped you, I think is an incredible... it's just to you, it's an ode to Malcolm Stern, who for me, you're the person that's gone through hell and come out the other end smiling. And you know that expression's often used. Oh yeah, he came out the other end smiling. But really, rarely do people smile after the sort of tragedy of losing a child. Nobody alive should have to bury a child. That is the number one worst thing, other than dying yourself and leaving family. So you are the inspiration, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here. So you know, thank you for having me on the show. And in answering your question, the OBE is or as they call it in America, hi, Mr. Colin Lester Balsam, OBE. OBE. And some of them OBE. But you know, the honor of it is huge, you know, to have something signed by Her Majesty the Queen. And the Duke of Edinburgh, an award to my name, is way beyond my wildest dreams. And the fact that I received it for services to the music industry and for charity is an even bigger accolade, I guess, for me, because the charity part of it, and OBE, for those who don't know, it's the OBE stands for, and I was just about to say, an officer of the highest order of the British Empire. And I don't really look like an officer of the British Empire, but I take that title very seriously. You know, it's not something they go, oh, great, I'll stick that after my name and maybe it will help me in certain things. It's there as a reminder of what I must continue to do, and really in the name of my father, because in 1945, the British government, Winston Churchill, allowed 634 refugees, as they were, although they hated being called refugees, displaced people coming over from the Holocaust in Germany, in Poland, and they could only find 1,000 alive. And sorry, they could only find 634 alive. They allowed 1,000 to come into the country. Do excuse me, it's quite emotional for this, but they allowed 1,000, but I could only find 634 alive to come here. One of them was my father, Harry Balsam. And the fact that they'd allowed my father to come here and build a new life, this country had, for me, it's the greatest honor you can bestow upon a family. You know, it was a rebirth of someone who really should have been killed many, many times. So for me to be able to do something back for that country, although that wasn't my motives initially, it always has my father in the back of his mind that this is a country, or UK is a country that gave my father a place to learn how to speak English, to learn how to earn money, have a very comfortable life, successful business. And I have the greatest respect for any country, sovereign or other, that allows people to practice their religion and practice freely and speak freely within their environment.
That's beautiful, Colin. And your dad was also an inspiration to me. And we'll talk a bit more about Harry because his story is quite extraordinary and has obviously deeply impacted you. And I know that's very emotional for you. And I was just thinking about this interview the other day. And I was thinking about going to your son's bar mitzvah many, many years ago. And
Gosh,
I was sitting at a table.
Angry.
Yeah, yeah, I bet you are. And I was sitting at a table with the boys, they were called themselves the boys, who came over with Harry from the Holocaust. And there's these old men sitting at the table. And then the music started playing. And I watched these men dance with every ounce of their being. And I saw what it was to really treasure being alive, because they'd come so close to being dead, as your dad was, so close so many times. And his story is quite extraordinary. And also the heroism that he showed. I know that he actually formed a relationship of sorts with the commandant of the camp and was able to help other people stay alive as well. So perhaps you could tell us a bit more about your dad's journey as a young boy in Poland who suddenly finds himself in the concentration camps in the Second World War.
Well, it all started one day when his father came home, and I'll try and condense this as much as I can. But
it's fine.
It started one day when his father came home, and he had sister, three brothers, mother, father. They lived in a flour mill in a place called Gorlitz. Gorlitzy in Poland, and his father said, "Come on, grab what you can. We get on the horse and cart, and we're going east. The Germans are coming from the west. We're going to go east." And so they loaded up the car and off they went. And about, I don't know, 15 miles down the road and going east, the horses needed food. They needed rest, so they thought they'd stay over with some relatives that evening. And carry on their journey the following morning. When my grandfather saw a train on the tracks, and when I say on the tracks, I mean on the tracks, because we all assume that we get on a train at a station, and there it is; it's at our level. We walk on, but actually, the train, is as tall as goes down into the track. So they're quite high to get on top of it, especially if you're going to get onto the top of a cargo train. So they had to climb up, and my father said, "Look, you stay all to his sister, brothers, my father," and he had his eldest brother, Danny, and said, "You help me, the rest of you stay in the stay on the horse and cart, and we'll load it up." And as they got up there and they were loading it up, and I don't really know, nobody really knows, because this was so traumatic. So my father tells a slightly different story to my uncle, who both of them have passed away now, unfortunately. But they both told a different story. And in fact, my uncle went to the extent of blanked it out completely and never actually accepted it happened until he went back there, I think about 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. No, it is a lot longer, in fact, because my father was alive. So, I mean, 20 years ago, he really didn't accept it happened, because my father obviously kept asking him, "How come you went? Why did it pull out? Why did you leave us on the tracks?" And really, they couldn't jump from the top of this train. And I've been there, and I can see the height of it. I get it. But anyway, they stayed on the train, and they said at the time, "Look, when they did meet up, they said, we thought you were going to come back. We waited at the station. We waited there. We thought you were going to come back on the next train and get us." And my uncle and grandfather said, "Well, we thought you were going to get the next train and we'd meet you at the destination." No one knew the destination. So neither of those happened. It was the last train east and it was the last train west. There were no more trains. So eventually they went back to their home, thinking that's it, maybe they'll come home at some point. And by then the Germans had invaded Poland, and the Polish had surrendered, and they were then put into the Gorlitz, Gorlitz ghetto. And that's where his story really started. And we've all seen pictures of the ghettos and the horrors of them. But when you visit and you smell, smell is an incredible sense. You know, and when we watch films and we watch documentaries and we watch terrible things, the one thing we really lack is smell. And smell changes an environment. You know, it's also, you know, when you walk into a place and it smells of, like, for me, if I walk into a place and it's got shiny, you know, just had polished floors, and it reminds me of my first day back at school, you know, in the new term, we always used to smell of this, you know. And so smell is an incredible sense. And when you smell what was going on, that disgust in a ghetto, and even that would comparative to the camps, you realize that they were living like animals, even in the ghetto. And my father used to break out every night with break out of the camp with his brother, Sunak, and they would then go and try and steal some food in the town, you know, do what they could to get some food for the family and whatever they could do, cigarettes, etc., etc. And one day they were out there, and you had to be 12 years old. The armband, Star of David armband that you were forced to wear as a Jew, you only had to wear from 12 upwards. So my father was 11 at the time, and his brother was 12, and he didn't have to wear the armband. And out he went. But of course, his brother took the armband off. You're not going to walk around, you know, the streets with an armband as a Jew. However, unfortunately, he was recognized by someone in his class who shouted at a Gestapo guard, it happened to be. He's a Juden, Juden, Juden. He's a Juden. He was in his class. He recognized him as a Jew. And the gentleman, or I don't know why I called him a gentleman, but, you know, he certainly wasn't a gentleman. He was one hell of an animal, actually. And that's disregard. I like animals, and animals are great. You know, in fact, I'd be doing disjustice. So this animal of a guy, this foul, vicious animal, just shot him dead there on the spot, right next to he didn't know my father, but he shot his brother there and then. My father ran, you know, he wasn't going to be hanging around. And he ran. And then he had two problems. And one problem was, apart from being caught, what they did, well, two problems. The one problem was, how do you, as an 11-year-old, tell your mother that you know, and we just discussed it, you know, about burying a child. We just discussed it. I just, you know, mentioned it at the top of, you know, the top of this conversation about Melissa. And how do you do the same thing? You know, the circumstances are very different, but the situation is identical. You know, how do you tell a mother that her son has just been murdered, executed? So that was his first problem. The second problem was, he was fully aware that when the Germans killed someone of a family, they would find out who the person was. They would go into the ghettos at night, bring the family out onto the streets, and shoot them all dead. And that's how they controlled them. Because, you know, otherwise, you're killing people's children. They're just going to go mad and start throwing things and trying to overtake. You know, it wasn't what the Germans did. So he knew that his family was in danger, but he was too scared to go home and tell his mother that Sunak had been executed. So he did the next smart thing. He went to a relative and explained to the conversation. And the first thing they were most concerned about was the family being murdered. So his cousin had the sense to use some of his contacts with the soldiers, and managed to convince the Jewish capos, the people that kept the Jews in place — they were Jews themselves — that they weren't going to be a threat, everything was going to be okay, and could he go and speak to the Germans and try and, you know, get them a reprieve, which he did. So my father already saved his family at that point, at the age of 11, and went back to the ghettos with his cousin, who then told the family. And there begins, you know, my father's story, if you like. You know, let's roll the titles now and start the film. But, you know, pre-titles is enough of anyone's life, if you like, to have been, you know, completely, you know, wrecked, if you like, thrown into the most ridiculous situation for someone of that age.
I mean, even as you speak about it, Colin, I can feel my skin sort of like, you know, sort of like wired as I listen to that, you know, what that must be like for an 11-year-old boy whose world is suddenly tipped upside down, where there's no safety, there's nothing, and he had to learn to live on his wits, which he most certainly did. And you and I have had conversations about him in the concentration camps and his relationship with the commandant, and how he managed to survive. And how he managed to survive is the most extraordinary story. And also what he did to make something of himself once he came across to the UK afterwards. But let's take a little bit more of a look at what happened to him in the camps and some of the stories that have emerged from there.
Yeah, I mean, the camp that he ended up in was Plushoff, and he'd been separated by that time from his mother and his brothers that had been put on a train, taken to Belzac, way east, and put straight into the gas ovens. So that was the end of that. The only reason that he survived is on boarding the train. In fact, he tells a story where he said, I pushed everyone, we knew by then that you know, we were being murdered. It wasn't no longer a secret. And I pushed my mother and you know, family to the front, my sister and brother, and said, look, I don't want to watch everyone be killed. Let me be killed first. And then we don't have to watch everything. You know, it's going to be, I mean, this is an 11, 12-year-old boy now. It just bears, you can't think about it. I can't think about it as I'm saying it. You know, can I be, you know, first to be shot so I don't have to watch you? That would be the kindest thing in his life at that time that you could give that child, was, I don't want to watch you die, so I'd like to be killed first, please. And as they boarded the train, because they didn't shoot them, they expected to be shot as they went out of this factory they were being held in, a shoe factory in Germany. And as they were getting on the train, he was pulled to one side because he was quite a big boy for his age, and they needed people to work. They needed people to bury the dead Jews, you know, and the gypsies that they had been murdering all around the town. And he was pulled aside to do that. And that was the last he saw of his family. And before he went into Plushoff, he was filling in mass graves. And remember, you know, you're talking about small towns. You know, he knew people that he was burying in mass graves, one of which I found through a cousin of mine. And deep in the forest, when he found it, it was really untouched and unfound. That was very emotional, just to imagine that here's this boy at 12 having to do that. And when I spoke to my father about it, he said to me, you know, he said, what worried me wasn't at this point now dying. He said, I was more concerned about who was going to bury me after I was killed, because I was really frightened of being eaten by wolves. You know, he said, that was his fear. So, you know, he'd been so reduced already to they'd already taken away any sense of dignity, you know, and this was just the beginning.
Wow. And then he spent 6 years, was it, in the camp?
Yeah, he spent 6 years in different camps, in Plushoff, where the very famous Schindler's List was filmed. And he lived in the house with the commandant, was Müller, of that camp. And he lived in the house with him, and it was an awful experience. Although, you know, he was very smart and he was very astute, and he made sure that Müller got everything he wanted. He became his shoeshine boy, and the way he became the shoeshine boy is they were standing what became known as a Pärlaplatz, where they had the roll calls on, and you know, we were in what is a car park, essentially. And they were being counted and they were waiting to go into Plushoff. And, you know, there was a lot of people standing there. And what the older boys did was push the younger ones to the front. They didn't want to be in the front line. And here they were in this courtyard. And eventually Müller started addressing them and telling them, you know, they'll behave, and what the ethic was behind the behavior in this camp. And my father was pushed to the ground by one of the older boys, just in his, you know, just to get behind. This, at this point, really, it was about, you know, saving people. You know, you have to save yourself. This was self-preservation, not for everybody, but for a large number. And you can understand that, and I get it. But he was fell to the floor, and about an hour later, at the end of this conversation, he was told, pointed out, and told to come into the commandant's office. And he thought, that's it, you know, they're going to shoot me. Come over here, boy, get in that room, blah, blah, blah. And he said he's never been more petrified in his life. He was shaking. He was, you know, completely, that was it. He was about to be shot. And I can't say it but my father tells it in German. He said, you know, he said, you know, you're the boy that got pushed over And you got really, you know, covered in mud and everything from being pushed over in this, you know, sort of horrible car park with rain everywhere, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, "You're a clean Jew. I saw you go to a puddle and clean your hands off. So you're a clean Jew. You're now going to be my, houseboy, shoeshine boy, and go and get my boots cleaned in the camp and get them shined up." He said, "And don't get me a new pair. Just go and get me. I want them back as soon as possible and get them cleaned up." So he ran into the camp, found the, you know, it's quite interesting because in Plaszów, and I've been there, they have like caves, and one cave was for the horseshoes and for shining shoes and, you know, whatever. It was a sort of, it's hard to explain from my vision of it, but he went there and, and the guy said, "No, you can't get these cleaned. You know, basically, fuck off. You know, I've got enough to do here. You don't need to be sitting here. I'm not doing that." And he said, "Well, this is Muller's shoe, so I'll go and tell Muller that you wouldn't clean his shoes, and that'll be the end of you." "Oh, no, give me the shoes, give me the shoes." And this guy cleaned them, but absolutely cleaned them beyond anything. And by which time Muller was getting really angry. He wanted his shoes. So he sent someone into the camp to go find this guy. "I want my shoes. I don't know where he's gone. Maybe he's run away with them and he's trying to find him and kill him." And eventually they sort of, I don't know, bumped into each other, I guess. And he said, "I've got the shoes. I've got the shoes." Took them back to Muller. And Muller then whacked him around the head and said, "I told you I didn't want new shoes. You know, I didn't want new ones. I want my shoes back." And my father said, "These are your shoes. He just cleaned them up. Perfect. Put them on. Put them on." And he put them on and he went, "Okay, they are my shoes." And this guy was so frightened that was cleaning them. He knew he had to make them like new. This was Muller, you know, the camp murderer, the commandant. So he then became the very, very efficient shoeshine boy for him in Plaszów.
Extraordinary. And I know that he influenced Muller in not killing people at times as well. That your father, he knew how to bob and weave. He knew how to find his way through things. With all the fear that was there, he became very astute, like an animal trapped in a cage. He knew how to make his life worthwhile. And I believe your father was bar mitzvahed in the camp. Is that
He was one of the
correct?
few people ever to be bar mitzvahed in the camp, you know. And coming back to what you're saying, Malcolm, it was fight or flight. You know, it's that, you know, there was no choice. It wasn't a case of, you know, I'm gonna try this and try that. It was fight or flight. It was instant, you know, and you lived on the, you know, edge of your nerves. And I think I've inherited, you know, literally some of that sort of angst and fight or flight at times in my life. You
Well,
know,
of course, you will have done because I've done quite a bit of work with a guy called Thomas Hubel who does work with something called intergenerational trauma. And we carry the wounds of our parents inside ourselves. So you
right.
will carry some of Harry's wounds. You also carried some of Harry's ability to make your life into something really profound and to become somebody, which is what Harry became as well. And you've become, one of the best pop managers in the UK, possibly in the world. And I've seen how some of your acts treat you, that they have an enormous respect for you. You know how to be with people. You know how to bob and weave and find your way through things, as Harry did.
He
And so
did.
Harry was 6 years in the camps and went through all sorts of privations in that place, and then came to the UK. And in fact, he stayed with my parents for a year soon after he came back.
Uncle Mo and Auntie Helen.
So
Your father,
that's
Mo Stern,
quite something.
was also had a very big influence on me.
And I keep saying that, yeah. And my dad used to tell me that Harry used to wake up every night screaming and crying. Incredible effect on us. But he found the power to make something of himself, and he became a successful businessman. He became someone who was well loved by everyone who knew him. And I knew that your love for him is one of the most beautiful things I've seen with a father and son, that there was such a deep love between the two of you. And he was your inspiration.
Am
And
I?
And so
I miss
how
him.
do you
I mean, this is emotional for me, and I can see for you, but I miss him. You know, there's not a day that goes by, but it, you know, life goes on.
Life goes on, and actually, you carry a legacy of a man who survived against all the odds. You carry a legacy of that man, and you found a way of giving your life real purpose. And I think there's very much in accordance with the fact that actually you had a dad who inspired you in such a big way. So
very much inspired me to be able to
yes.
act like that in such adversity and the odds of survival. You know, people always say, and I get asked a lot, you know, wow, they must have been lucky to survive. And of course they were lucky to survive, but every person that survived was lucky. But they lived on their wit's edge, and they wanted survival just more than the others. And so many people just resigned to the fact of, you know, this is it. My family's been murdered. Take me away, you know. But he had this, you know, instinct, I'm going to survive it. And wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing to have.
And as an 11, 12-year-old boy, it would have been quite easy to just go, I can't stand it, you know, I'd rather die.
Yeah.
And he had a survival spirit in him that I saw over the years. So how did this impact on you? What's been your life journey with Harry, post-Harry, now doing what you do? Tell us a little bit about what it is you do. I know that you're a rock manager and a quite successful one as well.
Yeah, I'd like to think we're sort of, you know, have reasonable success in what I've done. I started off as a musician. You know, a budding rock star, I think. You know, I thought, wow, this is going to be great. You know, literally wine, women and song. But I didn't realise I had to be, you know, an accomplished musician to achieve that. So when I was 12, my grandfather bought me a guitar, an acoustic guitar for my birthday, which cost £10. I remember very well. And I never realised you had to use both hands to play guitar. So I hear something, but I never realised you had to actually use both your hands. And I thought it was like really easy, but I accomplished that, joined a band, signed to a record label called Jet Records that was owned by the infamous Don Arden, Sharon Osbourne's father, who was known as potentially the first, allegedly first mafia man in the music industry back in the 70s. And
that's
that
a
was...
brief interlude. I just want to share something about Don Arden. I don't know if I've told you this story before, but I worked for Greenpeace. And Jeff Lynne from Electric Light Orchestra offered a penny an album for the song The Whale, which they made. And it sold 8 million copies. So we were due 80 grand. And Don Arden wasn't paying us. So I used to hustle him and say,
shit.
Can we get the money? He said, Come round to my office. I went round to his office, sits me down. He says, If I hear from you again, I'm going to shoot your fucking kneecaps off. Now piss off. And I never went near him again. So anyway, so he worked for the infamous Don Arden.
Yeah, he was definitely infamous. He hung Ronnie Wood out of his window for doing the same as you. You know, it wasn't reserved for you. So you, just to help you feel a bit better about it, when Ronnie Wood, now Ronnie Wood Rolling Stones, you know, went for some royalties there, he hung him out the window of his office and you know, probably had the same words with him. And that was the end of that. So he wasn't a particularly nice man. You know, I left that group, moved on. I went to work at Abbey Road Recording Studios as a sort of house engineer, house producer, producing tracks for and demos for bands that EMI were interested in, and that sort of got me into management, because I remember one day someone said to me, Colin, do you know any engineers? You know, recording engineers. I said, yeah, of course I know. Recording engineers, you know, I was at Abbey Road every night. And they said, well, we've got an album project that's going to pay quite a bit of money. You know, we need an engineer who's going to earn 250 a day, or maybe it was 300 a day, actually. 300 a day, which is a lot of money even then. £300 a day for a six-month album project, you know. And I went into work that night, and I remember saying to the engineer I was with, who went on to be very successful as a record producer, Ian Grimble, and I said, Ian, you know, surely you don't want to stay here for the rest of your life. You know, what about doing something as an independent, you know, go and leave and do your own stuff? And he said, I'd love to do that, but, you know, it's about finding the right job. I said, well, I have got you a job for 6 months, pays, you know, I think it was 250 or 300 a day. I can't quite remember. And that's you. And you can now go and be, you know, an engineer outside of here. And he took the job. Great for me. I was earning £50, £60 a day. had done the deal, nothing to do for 6 months. And I thought, well, this is easy. I'm £60 a day, better off now. This is quite interesting, this 20% business. And the only thing that I will say is it didn't really excite me. You know, that was a deal. And the deal was nice. But beyond that, musically, you know, I had a taste of what I wanted to do musically. So it sort of was my introduction to management, and then went on to manage acts like the Brand New Heavies, a huge album, Brother Sister, which was a massive success worldwide. We signed Travis, myself and my business partner Ian McAndrew. We signed Travis when they were in art school. We signed Craig Davey to our record label, which we had Wildstar Records. You know, we signed the Arctic Monkeys for management, Reverend and the Makers, lots of acts, Conor Reeves, many acts I can go through, and I don't want to miss some out, but Carleen Anderson, there were lots, you know, and we were at the time very successful as a management company, and as a record label. So really, that was my sort of intro into it, and was lucky enough to have signed this young kid from Southampton called Craig David, lovely, lovely guy. And I remember going down to his council estate, and I think I can't remember what car I had, but it'd probably been a BMW or something like that. And I remember him saying to me, if you leave your car there, it won't have wheels when you get out. You know, he came to meet me and I said, I'm really not that bothered. Go play me some hits and I don't care about wheels. And and I went up and met his very humble, his mother and grandmother, which was an amazing experience in this small council flat. And his bedroom was tiny. And I mean tiny, but it was stacked from ceiling to floor with vinyl. This guy was the real deal, you know. And it was, I'm going to sign you to the label. You know, I love the fact that you're 16 years old. You wrote a song called Walking Away. I'm walking away from the troubles in my life. I'm walking away, trying to find a better day. And I just thought anyone that's written that at that age is very talented. And we started working together in, I think that was the year 2000, and we're still working together today. You know, I actually sold my shares in the label many years ago, and I've continued to manage Craig through all the deals that I've done along the way and other businesses that I've been involved with and still am. I've still continued to manage Craig. He's become a very good friend, and really a family member to me. You know, it's just a pleasure working with someone so complete as a human being.
It's funny, you know, because I think it was, I think again, this was your son's bar mitzvah. And I went there, and normally you've got the sort of bar mitzvah band, you've got the local band who are sort of doing their thing. And I didn't know much about Craig at the time. And suddenly Craig David comes on, starts singing, and it's like, this is what an accomplished, talented, brilliant musician does. And although it's not my type of music particularly, I'm a Leonard Cohen fan, sort of the, you know, the soft, soulful elder.
It's hallelujah.
Like, it's hallelujah. This guy was magic. And I just realized that there is that sort of that ingredient that someone has that makes them magic. What makes Eric Clapton magic? What makes Mick Jagger magic? What makes Craig David magic? And I've been lucky enough to come to some concerts of his with you. And again, although it's not music that I normally would listen to, I watch a craftsman performing with every ounce of his being who's got unutterable talent.
Just talent is you know, I do you know that this is really interesting, because you know, with the sort of artists that I've signed, from rock bands to if you use the Brand New Heavies, were acid jazz, you know, it's sort of funk really, but got titled as acid jazz, you know, to the Arctic's independent, the Arctic Monkeys, which is, you know, really in indie rock. And I was, this was the strange thing, that when I was awarded my OBE, Princess Anne at Windsor Castle, normally those of us that have been fortunate enough to meet the royals on various occasions, and I was exceptionally fortunate to meet Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace at a reception, the questions are very general. And I get it, you know, they've got a lot of people to get through. Oh, hi, and what do you do? Even though they know what you do because they've been forewarned, et cetera, et cetera. And actually brings me a story that I was in at this particular reception in Buckingham Palace, and in the lineup was Eric Clapton, as you just mentioned him. Eric Clapton was in the lineup. Phil Collins was in the lineup. So they had, it was a reception for artist managers. You know, so they chose certain artist managers to come. I was one of them, and certain musicians and certain record producers and certain record company executives. And so they made it as a mixture of that. And in the lineup, the Queen actually asked Eric Clapton, and what do you do? Which I thought was a fantastic, like, and I heard it with my own ears. And Phil Collins answered for him, said, he's a very accomplished musician, man, should I say. And it was just hilarious. So sorry, just coming back onto
Oh no,
your
that's great.
Eric Clapton.
And it's like you do see it when someone's got this. It's
Sorry,
almost like a
finishing this.
power.
I'm sorry, because
Go.
I'm sorry, you get old when you get to my age and you don't finish the story. But the point I was making, that when Princess Anne gave me the OBE, she her words to me beyond the general chat, which I just thought would be like, oh, great, congratulations, what do you do? Move on. She said to me, you know, you've signed lots of different musical genres in your career. You've worked with lots of different musical genres. What are you into? What sort of music are you into? Which I thought was an incredibly deep question for someone where I just thought they were going to pin it on me and move me along. And we had a good chat about that. And a wonderful person. She really is. Very interesting. And however well briefed, she really was interested.
And I think what I see with you is like what I see with the musicians, that they've got these musicians who are really accomplished, who really are sort of shaking the world with their music. They've got something comes through them. You've got, and I wrote about this in my book, Slay Your Dragons with Compassion. I wrote about the radar that we have. And there's something in you that's got a radar. You recognize when someone's got something. And I've seen you in social situations. You know who's got something to say, and you know who you're going to humor and just sort of like, chat about it and move on. So there's
I didn't
something.
realize I was that transparent, Malcolm.
Yes, transparent to
Be
me.
more careful.
Yes. But it's like I really recognize that actually you've found your groove and you've made something of your groove. And I think a lot of you has done it in honor of your father, Harry.
Absolutely.
And actually that's, for me, there's such a I'm so touched by the relationship between father and son. And I start to see it now with my grandson and my son. I can see that actually the relationship between father and son is so vital. And you once said to me, Harry's your hero. And
Yeah,
he was a
it
hero.
is. Still is. And I often think, what would he do in this situation? And then I don't necessarily follow it because I'm not sure that it would be acceptable in today's world. But it's incredible to have come from a father that was, everything was black and white to him, and himself, along with all of the survivors. And I grew up with survivors because they were my family. They were my father's family. They didn't. They had no hatred. Their whole life, their whole being was about creating a new family. It wasn't about hating the people that destroyed their generations and children and family. It wasn't about hate. They really. I've never been so in awe of so many people that have been through such harshness and came out the other side without hatred. I mean this with the greatest respect. Christianity is obviously, forgiveness, is full of forgiveness. And that's where, that's the path. Their path was very, very different, from Christianity. They were being murdered by Christian people. And so the fact that they came out with that very same view of, it's about loving, it's not about getting revenge. It's not about seeking justice. It's just about creating a new generation. And thankfully, we're five generations deep since then. And so, I'm second generation. We're into five generations deep now, which really is, that's victory. That's what victory looks like. So when people say, well, how do obviously, 6 million were murdered. How can there be any victory? Well, the victory is now. And long may it grow.
And long may it grow, because I've again, it's almost like we set patterns and molds for ourselves as we go. And I've watched you with your son Jack, and I've seen that this boy really rates you and values you. It's almost like there's a saying that the sins of the fathers
Worrying,
are on
that's
the children.
worrying.
It's worrying. It's true, but actually, what I can also see is
That's
that
a lovely view.
the love of the father transmits onto the son as well. And of course, onto the daughter. I know your daughter Emily as well, that there's a sort of sense that you bring love to your family and you are creating a role model there, built from out of, the dust of your dad's almost demise and his family being decimated as well. So I think
That's
that,
true.
you know, what I see is that you are bringing your love to the world. You're bringing your love of music to the world. And I've seen your relationship with Craig, where there's just such a deep connection between you. He's inspired by the fact that you've actually embraced him, taken him on, and he's got a rock in you. And I think that that's something about you, Colin, that you've become a rock for many people. And I know you, I won't tell the story about you and Travis, but I know that you actually were a rock for them, and actually you sort of like you kept them in line. And I think the people who've been lucky enough to be managed by you have actually had a father figure who's actually been able to hold them in that environment.
Well, that's true. Travis, I don't know about holding them in line, but they were certainly, great bunch of guys. And I'm still very much in contact with Fran Healy, the singer who's living in LA now. Still very close to him, and we speak from time to time. And I still watch over him in a fatherly manner if he tells me, he recently, unfortunately, got divorced. And, that actually personally shocked me, on a personal level. Now, why would it? I've not sort of, lived in LA. I've seen him in LA from time to time. I visit quite a lot LA work-wise. But it affected me, quite deeply because I'm very, he's like family to me. They it becomes, in music, it's not just about understanding. I don't do love you baby, want you baby music. That's not my thing. I leave that to the experts in pop. So for me, it's about, the words that you've written. What are you saying? Like I said about, so
I'm walking away, yeah, from the troubles
walking away,
of my life.
yeah, absolutely. In the same way that Fran Healy, has great lines of, why does it always rain on me? Is it because I lied when I was 17? That story comes from, I remember Fran came into the office, and he had writer's block after the first album, Good Feeling, had huge, it really was gonna, it was gonna set the world on fire, and actually sold 30,000 copies that really pretty much set a lot of money on fire. So it burnt his through way through over £1 million, and I remember him coming in and going, I need to write for the second album, but I've got writer's block. And we said to him, look, get on a plane and go somewhere warm, go somewhere warm, Fran, and take your guitar with you and just chill out and just reduce the pressure on you. And he said, well, and Fran, believe it, he didn't like flying. I mean, this is a sort of strange for a rock star because they fly all over the world. He may well be over it now. He does fly all over the world. And he said, well, where? I don't like going very far. I said, do you know what? Why don't you go to Eilat? And this was around October, November. And the year was probably 99, 98, 99. And he said, okay. I said, it's 4 hours away. And it's really hot. It's the Red Sea. It's really beautiful. You can swim in the sea. Amazing, underwater wildlife. It's really, really, it's a beautiful place, and you may get inspiration there. And he said, okay, and off it went, and we booked the trip, and off he went, and this beautiful, place in the middle of so many, on one Jordan one side, Egypt the other side, in a very, even now, obviously forever, a very difficult terrain, if you like. He found beauty in it. However, it pissed down with rain every single day.
Why does it always rain on me? So
And then he wrote that chorus, Why Does It Always Rain On Me? Funny enough,
fantastic.
the verses I remember, if I remember rightly, in Italy, but that chorus, Why Does It Always Rain On Me, was written after a day on a glass bottom boat in Eilat. You just don't know where real writer's inspiration is gonna go. And lyrics mean a lot to me. I mean, the reason that I chose Fill Me In to be Craig David's first single on his record was the one line in there he wrote, young people doing what young people do, parents trying to find out what they're up to. I mean, isn't that just exactly what it is? If your parents aren't fucked off with you, then you're not going to do it. You're like, you're okay with me growing my hair long? I mean, you're okay with me smoking weed? Oh, well, maybe it's not cool to do it. So it's always been the antithesis to what your parents want is what you do it to. So that line in itself gave Craig to his own, sort of culture, his own people, his own age group. And that's something that I continue to hopefully do well, is just look for that, for the artist that can talk to his generation.
And that's the beauty, isn't it?
And that is the importance of it. And when I no longer have the ability to do that, that's when I'll say, I don't get it anymore. But, you know, listen, we all wake up and go, I don't understand this. I don't understand. And most of that's to do with politics and you know, sort of wars that really are happening that are not our own. Some of them are and some of them aren't. But the real, when you strip it all back, we do understand our environment, you know, if our eyes are open.
I think that's right. And James Hillman, the psychotherapist, says that inside every one of us is a diamond, a D-A-E-M-O-N, like a demon. And it would drive us mad to do what it is we were born to do. And it feels like you're doing what you were born to do. You're fulfilling something that wanted to be born in you, and you've touched other people along the way. So we're coming towards the end of our podcast.
And there you go, on Craig's first album, Born to Do It.
Oh, there you go. Perfect, perfect.
And that comes
wise
from...
man.
Well, ironically, that comes from the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. If you remember the beginning of that film, they all come out of school and they run into the guy's sweet shop, the guy with the brown coat on, and he holds out, you know, oh, Wonka's got a new bar up, you know, Wonka's got a new bar. And they hand him the bar, and the kid says to the guy in the shop, how does he do it? How does he do it? And he says, you don't ask a fish how it swims or a bird how it flies. They're just
Oh,
born
wow.
to do it.
Lovely.
So,
And then
you know,
who extracts wisdom from things happening around him that he observes.
Right, and that's within all of us. You know, if we search within ourselves, and I've learned that over the years, I don't think, you know, you're born with a certain amount of empathy, sympathy, and aggression. You know, and I think it's how you manage in your life to compartmentalize it and use it for the good rather than for the bad. You know, and I've been fortunate that I've had very good family, very good friends, and being very, very, you know, sort of well coaxed and well brought up in that sense, to have.
Well, you give love and you receive love. I mean, that's the thing. That's
Here we
about
go.
the Beatles line. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. I've watched you again with people and seen that you actually give love. So I'm going to come to this, the final
Always
question.
get what you want, though.
What's that?
Always get what you want.
And you can't always get it, but you
You
get
try
what
sometimes.
You get. It's true. So let's just take a look. The series is called Slay Your Dragons with Compassion. And for each of us, we've had to find something in ourselves that has led us to be who we are, something we've had to overcome. And I'm throwing this at you without any preparation. So we'll just see whether something emerges for you. But what's the dragon you've had to slay to become who you are?
I think if I'm going to be really honest,
Yeah, really honest, Colin.
anger.
Now I remember.
I
Wow.
think that I've had to, you know, it's that little guy on my shoulder that's like, you can't let him fucking talk to you like that. You know, and there I would be. And then, you know, as I've grown older, this guy said, don't listen to him, right? He's winding you up. And so I've had to deal with the anger, and that's where I believe it was the DNA that my father passed on to me. And I've looked into it about how can you have one generational DNA, but apparently you can. And that I think I really did have to deal with. And you know what, more so in a family environment, i.e., you know, with my wife, and, you know, they say that you take it out on people you love the most. And I think that's true. It has been true. And I've worked very, very, I worked very hard on making that, you know, a distant memory in my life. But I think that's, I would say that, you know, and that's the biggest change as well.
That's
To be able
beautiful. Yeah.
Without anything, just to love unconditionally and not lose my temper when someone's doing something that is not necessarily the way I would do it, or, you know, just straight into that fight or flight, I guess, that we were talking about earlier. And so that's been for me, you know, one of the things that's really changed in my life.
And it didn't come easily either, Colin, and I know that. It's like you actually had to sort of take yourself on in a therapeutic environment and actually sort of like really work through this deep anger. And of course, when we were looking before intergenerational trauma, you can see that how could you have been anything other than angry? How could your dad have been anything other than angry? And you found, it's like, it's almost like you've mellowed in your, I won't say your old age, because you're to me, you're young, but you've mellowed as you've grown older, that you've mellowed. And something in you
I have
found its way.
I've learned to tolerate, I think, and look at things slightly, I guess, you know, more three-dimensional, four-dimensional than you know. But I think that's the same for anyone. You know, when you're young, everything's black and white. And when grey starts coming into it, it's quite confusing because you're like, well, do I have to consider that there's black and white and there could be grey here? And then when you start learning that in business, in personal life, in the deals that I've done, and look, you'll find people in the world that go, Colin Mestre is a wanker, he's an arsehole, he's a, whatever you want to call me, you don't do my job for as long as I have done and not upset people. But you'll never find anybody, and in defense of people that I represent, and in defense of my family, I'm sure I've upset lots of people, hopefully never too deeply, but you do realize that you're doing that, for a reason. And I think that for me, you'll find people that can call me all sorts of things. What you'll never find is someone that I've ripped off, say, oh, he ripped me off, or, because the most important thing to me has been my reputation and my integrity. And if you lose either of those, your reputation, you're out of business, integrity, you're losing yourself. So I've never lost either of those and never would, Listen, we talk about in any business, and you can talk about. I work in sport as well now. I've started a sports division. I have a new record company. It's expanding. My son Jack's working in the business and doing an incredible job. And I often come into conversations and people talk about, oh, what about a backhander? And I have the same answer that I've always had is that, look, brown paper bags are for fruit, not for cash for me. I live my life that way.
And I know that's true. And we have to learn the hard way. And you've come through this sort of this rage, which again we talked about as well in the past. And I really appreciate the honesty you've brought to this interview. And I'm very, very grateful to you, Colin.
Always. If you could just edit all of it out, that's anything
Anyway,
that.
just, so this is Colin Lester. Goodbye. There we go.
Thank you very much. Yeah, just take
Thanks.
most of that out and just don't be you guys. No, it's look, it's and the thing about honesty is Amanda, my wife, often says to me, you're not very sugarcoat. When you tell someone about a track or someone asks you about music, you'll say, no, that's shit, move on. And I said, well, that is me. If you want my advice, which you're not going to hear, actually, by the way, because you're just going to hear what you want to hear at the point, I don't like it, I'm an arsehole for not liking it, it's no point. If you come back to me and want advice after thinking about it, great. But, I don't sugarcoat things. And that's because, and certainly as I've grown older, life's important. Time is the most important thing we've got. It's the most valuable commodity. You can't buy it, you can't sell it, you don't know how much you've got. So time is the commodity, and I sort of live by that now, and that's made me calmer. Definitely made me calmer. Malcolm,
Right.
I've got to say, Malcolm, I make an amazing, just completely, we're going to go off grid here. I make amazing sandwiches, okay? My wife will always say, if you want a sandwich, Colin's your man. And I do, I build sandwiches and et cetera, et cetera. But I have to tell you, the person who taught me that, and the inspiration is your father. Your father, he taught me, apart from many things, he taught. Wonderful, wonderful guy. Really massive, massive, massive respect and love for Uncle Mo. But he taught me how to build a great sandwich because no one builds it like Americans. And he was a GI that came over to England, and married your mother, an English lady in London. And it was just a wonderful. Growing up, he was without any shadow of doubt my favorite uncle. It was like Uncle Mo's coming around. Wow, I'd get really excited. And over the years, he had a massive influence on me, but I have to give him the sandwiches. He
Fantastic.
did a lot more than that, but the sandwich is what I carry through my life for him.
Well, you know, Harry, the interesting parallel here, Harry was my favorite uncle. And I remember Harry saying to me in the last year of his life, he said, I didn't talk about my experiences in the concentration camps for 50 years. And in the last year, I've just talked about it nonstop. And we had some beautiful exchanges about the suffering he'd been through and what he'd become. And I think you're a real credit to him, and I'm really grateful that you're my cousin and that we have this sort of
Listen,
engagement.
I'm so grateful to you as well. Just on that point is that the reason he didn't talk about it, which would be interesting for people to know, is the survivors didn't talk about it for a long time for two reasons. One, they didn't think people would believe them. And two, they were ashamed that it happened and that they'd allowed their families to die. So the fact they opened up to you is a testament to how much he loved you, Malcolm. And he did. He really did. And I do too. You really are a very special person. And it's been great talking to you today. I don't think I'd have opened up to many people the way that,
Beautiful.
I have today with you.
And I really appreciate, especially the stuff around the anger. It's like it's honourable to say there's a part of me that I've had to work through to become who I am.
Absolutely.
Colin, thank you so much. And
Thank you so much. And I send all my love to you, and hopefully see you soon, and good
yeah,
times.
let's do that. You're looking great. So
Thank you.
catch you later. Cheers then.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.